when you told me I wasn't right for you. It wasn't hard to believe, cause when I watched TV, I would
there is
this thing. Do you realize
what is there is this thing?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting not live, but still from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd.
And I'm Maya Ibbotson.
Today we broadcast from the Tsuut'ina, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations.
Today is Unfit to Print's Black History Month feature. This feature follows the history of British, Canadian, and American Black radio. Starting with the Civil Rights Movement, we highlight some iconic Black figures in radio, concluding with archives of CKUT's own Black Talk. We want to issue a content warning as this upcoming segment discusses anti-Black racism, colonialism, stereotyping, sexism, and slave labor, police brutality, and mentions of racial slurs, although not explicit. We will play some tunes before our headlines and then, of course, our feature. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after a short break. That was Leave Me Alone by Kay Trinata featuring Shaylia. Now for our weekly headline roundup, which this week is only one headline because we do have an extra long feature. But here it is. This announcement was released in the most recent SSMU email, and I thought it was fitting for today's episode. So here it is. Quote, under the theme Africa Beyond the Motherland, MASS is once again bringing you the Africa Speaks Conference. Even though we're gathering virtually this year, we're still bringing you exceptional panelists to discuss how to showcase our identity as Africans and show up confidently throughout our educational journeys and future careers as members of the diaspora. Please register here to reserve your seat and RSVP on the event Facebook page to receive in-time updates. We hope to see you on February 19th and 20th, 2021. Unquote. So you can find the Eventbrite link in the most recent email sent out by the VP University Affairs. And on Facebook, you can find the event page if you look up Africa Speaks Conference 2021.
As per usual, we have our COVID-19 updates from Sunday. As reported this weekend, Quebec reports 910 new COVID-19 cases with 15 more deaths. Additionally, as stated by the Montreal Gazette, quote, Montreal was again the region with the most new cases on Sunday with 397 cases, unquote. Currently, the province is at its lowest rolling average of cases since October. Quebec administered just 1,561 vaccine doses on Saturday. Trudeau is maintaining that all who will want a vaccine will receive one by September. As stated by the Montreal Gazette, quote, an Angus Reid poll released on Friday showed that just 28% of Canadians are confident that the September number is achievable, and 36% of people believe it will be 2022 before they have their shot. In a meeting with healthcare workers Thursday, Trudeau called the coming months the big lift, an end to a period of vaccine scarcity and a new challenge to get millions of doses out and administered, unquote. Although the overall trend of number in cases is decreasing, Christian Dubé, our health minister, still warns folks to proceed with caution and be wary of the more contagious COVID-19 variants. That was our weekly headline roundup. Now it's time for a quick groovy tune and then our audio essay.
My face, she brings me joy. She diss them niggas, yeah. Don't kiss them boys. I find a way, I'll make a ploy. I need that figure, yeah. She need this toy. Comes all the way from Illinois. I've never been, but I learned some more. Her fantasy. Perfect start. Swear she's the one, but I'm still employed at the North Face. Wasting my time just doing nothing. You're on my mind when I'm lonely. Maybe you'll find me in your own way. Searching for you. I thought I had won, but I
look up at the sun. I know I've begun a whole different world, another life.
That was Odie with North Face. You're listening to Unfit to Print on CKUT at 90.3 FM.
Now it's time for our Black History Month segment. This feature follows the history of British, Canadian, and American Black radio. Starting with the Civil Rights Movement, we highlight some iconic Black figures in radio, concluding with archives of CKUT's own Black Talk. We also mentioned the historical context of radio as a mass medium for revolutionary means. We want to issue a content warning as this upcoming segment discusses anti-Black racism, colonialism, stereotyping, sexism, enslaved labor, police brutality, and mentions of racial slurs, although not explicit. But without further ado, here is our segment. Today's Unfit's Black History Month feature, where we will be focusing on Black history in radio. We want to acknowledge that the Black experience is not monolithic and cannot be summarized with a few specific narratives. Furthermore, though we focus on Western history, we also want to note that events of Black history are not solely based in Western countries. In this episode, we aim to highlight historical and contemporary Black radio figures, as well as important conversations hosted by Black folks in and about radio.
Radio has a complicated history as a medium of liberation as well as control. During the European colonization in Africa, broadcasting technology played an influential role with imperialism. To understand the links between media and imperialism, it is necessary that we analyze technologies invented and utilized by colonists and how they have contributed to historical events. In a paper written by one of McGill's communications professors, Jenny Berman, we learn that colonial powers used tools of communication like radio and the telegraph to assert control over spaces and people. However, we can also see throughout history that people under colonial rule would repurpose these communication technologies for anti-colonial revolutionary means. In the 20th century, imperialist powers would broadcast propaganda across radio in attempts to civilize citizens. French colonial administrators emphasized the radio's potential to influence colonized communities, soldiers, and settlers. This was especially true in Algeria, where the first French colonial broadcasting station was set up in 1929. However, Black Algerians refused to absorb the colonial messages and eventually mobilized radio technology toward revolutionary ends. Radio was seen as a key conduit in the Algerian Revolution, acting as a medium to communicate and garner support for independence by the Black revolutionaries. The Algerian War was fought between France and the Algerian National Liberation Front from 1954 to 1962, and eventually led to Algeria winning its independence from France.
Radio is rooted in settler colonialism. However, through the efforts of revolutionaries, has been revised as a platform for awareness, raising culture, and all-around creativity. Now we'll get into a deeper analysis of the events and people that tie Black history to radio broadcasting. First, we want to start by taking a look at the golden age of Black radio in America. In the 1920s, during a post-war America, the Great Migration took place. Black Americans moved north to urban centers in order to fill labor shortages as a result of World War I. In the 1920s, American network broadcasters began to sponsor a couple Black radio shows. These shows were mainly targeted towards the growing demographic of Black radio audiences. However, these shows were still put on by white performers who performed just like radio comedy. The first weekly variety radio show featuring Black entertainers premiered on WSBC Chicago in 1929. Jack L. Cooper, the producer and host of the show, became the U.S.'s first Black radio announcer. By the 1940s, Black radio programs were gaining traction. After World War II, Al Benson took over Chicago's thriving radio scene and catered it more towards Black listeners. Benson sought to change the whitewash radio industry. He became a well-known radio personality working on 10 different radio stations. Lucky Cordell, a Chicago radio DJ, speaks here about Al Benson's fame.
I think when Benson came on, I was far more exposed to him because my family, you know, who all migrated from the South. I mean, when you came in the house, there was no TV, and usually the radio was on, and if it was evening, it was Al Benson. Powerful position.
Another influential figure in radio during the Jim Crow era was Harold Jackson. Harold Jackson was an African-American radio and play-by-play presenter who broke many barriers for people of color in radio in America. Jackson co-founded Inner City Broadcasting in New York City in 1971, which became the first entirely black-run radio station in the city. Jackson was the host of Sunday Classics till he was in his 90s, spanning over his 70-year career. Now we're going to play an NPR clip of Robert Siegel and Joel Rose talking about Jackson's influence in radio, including clips of Jackson himself.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. One of the pioneering voices of black radio has signed off for the last time. Hal Jackson was a talk show host, music DJ, sportscaster, and TV host in a remarkable career that spanned more than seven decades. NPR's Joel Rose has this remembrance.
Audiences in New York today know Hal Jackson as the host of the Sunday Classics show on WBLS.
A little shake, rattle, and roll. That's our man, Big Joe Turner.
Jackson continued hosting the show every Sunday afternoon right into his 90s. It was a victory lap at the end of a professional radio career that began more than 70 years earlier, when he walked into the offices of Washington, D.C.'s WINX to talk with the general manager.
He said to me, use the N-word, no N will ever work on this radio station, and I doubt any others. They're none working in Washington, you know. I said, I know how much it would mean to the black people of Washington if we had a show.
Jackson didn't take no for an answer. As he told NPR in 2001, Jackson got a white-owned advertising firm to buy time on the station, as was the practice in those days. Then he showed up 15 minutes before the show was scheduled to air.
Everybody was stunned, and I was scheduled to go on. They couldn't locate the manager wherever he was. Anyway, we went on the air, and the phones just lit up.
That led to Jackson's first talk show on WINX. A few years later, he branched out into music.
This is the house that Jack built. Again and again, you see. Featuring Harold Jackson over WLIB.
In 1949, Jackson was in New York hosting The House That Jack Built, as he told NPR in 2008.
We open up the musical doors, and we have recorded stars from here to Mars. Whether you're home or in your cars, you're relaxing with Jackson in The House That Jack Built.
Hal Jackson was born in South Carolina and grew up in Washington, D.C. In his memoir, Jackson recalls shining shoes and cleaning latrines at Union Station to save up money to buy a radio. His work ethic was legendary. At one point in the 1950s, he hosted three daily shows on three different New York stations with entirely different formats.
He kicked open the door for minorities and women in broadcasting.
Skip Dillard is the general manager at WBLS in New York, where Jackson worked until just a month ago when his health began to decline.
I could ask him and say, did you know, for instance, Alan Freed? And he could immediately recount working with Alan Freed back in his top 40 radio days.
Like Freed, though, Hal Jackson was caught up in a payola scandal, which forced him to leave radio. For a while, Jackson worked as a janitor to make ends meet.
I had no job, no way to take care of my family after that. So here I was, Mr. Big Shot, cleaning buildings at night so I could take care of my family.
But Jackson built a second career, this time in television, as the host of the Talented Teens International competition. And he helped found one of the first broadcasting companies owned solely by African Americans. Jackson wrote in his memoir that, quote, I never dwelt on what I couldn't do. I just went out and did it.
If you think you are beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you'd like to win and think that you can't, it's almost a cinch that you won't. Think that you can and you will. It's all in your state of mind.
Other notable black radio pioneers include Jack Gibson. At the time, Gibson was working in radio, Chicago only had around 4 to 5 black radio actors. The first all-black radio soap opera was produced in 1945 called Here Comes Tomorrow. It aired on WJJD Chicago and was created by black radio legend Richard Durham. Here's a clip of Jack Gibson, the star of Here Comes Tomorrow, speaking about the show.
And I got in at that time in the 40s, Chicago was a big radio drama center. And we got involved in doing soap operas. And in fact, one stands out in mind. A writer came along in 1945 and wrote the first all-Negro, at that time was the word, but it's black now, a soap opera called Here Comes Tomorrow. And it was such a controversial show that we were about 25 years before our time, that there were times that the script was so strong they used to have to take us out of the studios by freight elevators and put us in taxi cabs and go up the alley.
By the end of the 40s, stations across the U.S. began broadcasting more black music, playing blues and jazz music. Furthermore, northern and southern stations included more black-oriented programming. The beginning of the 50s ushered in the golden age of black radio. Atlanta's WERD, created in 1949 and hosted in part by Jack Gibson, was the first radio station owned and programmed by black broadcasters and creatives. Priska Neely of NPR notes that disc jockeys like Jack Gibson could make unknown musicians stars in moments, demonstrating why these early black radio stations were so important in prioritizing black music and artists across the country. The Golden Age marked a time in which radio was the most important mass media tool for communication amongst black communities. Professor Jackie Gales Webb at the University of Indiana, as well as the vice president at Radio at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, also known as CPB, put together a series of archives titled The Golden Age of Black Radio, an incredibly thorough and informative source that helped us write the segment. Webb notes that black radio played an important role in harnessing and uniting black communities. In the 1950s, black women began to make their mark in radio. Webb explains that by the end of the decade, black women, including DJs such as Shadi, Hattie Leeper, Novella, Dizzy Lizzie Smith, and Martha Jean, the Queen Steinberg, were featured on air. Shadi, in an interview, discusses the challenges of being a black woman in radio during this time.
There were mixed emotions there, me being the only female. There were some diehard men there that thought, well, you know, females should be home having babies, in the kitchen cooking. This is not an industry for females. And they tried to do little things to discourage me. Some of them, you know, they'd pull my hair. They would take my bows off, you know, because I was 16. They'd say, my God, you know, get your education because this is no place for you.
However, Vi Higginson, a jockey at WBLS, noted the support from other black women in radio circles was strong. In an interview, Higginson says, quote, "Since there hadn't been any women, I was afraid that the woman's reaction might not be positive hearing a woman on the air. But I was so wrong about that. The women were so supportive, and the sisters were so proud that it gave me courage. And I could talk to them. You know, I could be myself," unquote. As mentioned earlier, radio was one of the most popular mediums when it came to communication and awareness raising. For black communities in America, radio was a place to receive news, experience entertainment, and establish a sense of connection across the U.S. In the 50s and 60s, radio was instrumental in spreading and discussing violence as a result of segregation, alongside the overall civil rights movement. Many famous black disc jockeys were outspoken in their activism on and off air. Black radio stations would organize and promote events like the March on Washington by broadcasting them on air. Communications between leaders, preachers, and members of the black community were facilitated through radio. In fact, Jack Gibson's WERD station was actually headquartered in an office right above the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. If the SCLC had a civil rights message to get on air, such as from their president, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., they would tap their ceiling with a broom handle, notifying WERD. At a conference in Atlanta in 1967, Professor Webb points out that Dr. King, in his speech, credits radio as a medium, explaining that, quote, "If it had not been for the prominence of Black personality disc jockeys at different places throughout the South, that the movement never would have gotten started," unquote.
Another notable figure in radio is Kathy Hughes. Hughes, who started out as a disc jockey at Howard University, eventually became the founder and chairperson of Urban One, also known as Radio One. As stated on her website, quote, "In 1980, Hughes purchased her flagship station WOL AM in Washington, D.C., and pioneered yet another innovative format, 24-hour talk from a Black perspective. In 1999, Kathy Hughes became the first African-American woman to chair a publicly held corporation. Hughes became the first woman to own a radio station that was ranked number one in a major market. Radio One also diversified and launched the television network TV One in 2004 and entered the digital space with Interview One, now iOne Digital, in 2007, unquote. Here's a clip of Hughes explaining her experience at Howard and as a woman in radio.
It's time to come together.
It's fascinating to me that women in this industry still do not get the credit that they deserve. My lack of recognition as the creator of The Quiet Storm is a classic case of sexism in the industry, because even the brothers who know, many of whom work side by side with me at Howard University, won't part their lips to say a woman created that show. That was her concept. That bothers me very much, because women have made some incredible contributions in broadcasting, but our industry is still very much the old boy network. And the only thing that has changed is some of those old boys have melanin and look like me now.
American Black Radio holds deep cultural and social roots. Black voices are the reason for the mobilization of social justice issues, exposure, and community building.
Black British voices have strongly influenced radio and radio invention. As stated by Toby Kiramatang in her article, Sound of the Underground, How Black Britain Changed the Face of UK Radio, pirate radio exists in many formats, quote, from the podcast started in bedrooms of friends to the inventive audio content that reimagines the way we share stories, unquote. Starting in the 1930s, this type of radio production and recording is a form of pirate radio, which is essentially radio without a license.
According to Toby Cheramatang, there is a continuous struggle to find genuine audio content on Black culture and experience. Black British pirate radio began in the 1980s in the UK. Known as the first Black-owned pirate radio, DBC was run out of West London by Leroy George Anderson, aka DJ Lepke, playing reggae, R&B, soul, funk, among other genres. Lloyd Bradley was a past DBC DJ, and when asked about DJ Lepke's career, stated that he was, quote, effectively laying down a cultural marker, the ripples from which were absolutely critical in shaping mainstream British music in the 21st century, unquote.
Pirate radio has changed and grown over the years with many different influences. KISS FM was originally a pirate radio station, which largely influenced pirate radio's reputation. KISS FM and stations like it were significant for the Black community and promoted Black voices in popular culture. The station and Black pirate radio largely informed youth and street culture. KISS FM acquired its full radio license in 1990, becoming the first Black pirate radio station to do so.
Pirate radio, while most popular for its musical influence, also created a space for news and discussion for specific communities. The local element of some pirate radio stations, such as Weekend Black Listener Station, or WBLS Radio, broadcasted local events in London and was the city's first Ghanaian station, founded in the 90s. The station had the largest Ghanaian listenership in the UK at the time. Not only did pirate radio create a platform for music and expression, but many local Black pirate radio stations, quote, became an independent source of familiarity for newly arrived communities in the UK seeking a home away from home, unquote.
Now we will play a clip from the 1980s from the BBC interviewing some of the Black British DJs that worked at the DBC, followed by a clip of an interview with DJ Lepke explaining the feeling he first got when going live.
Ready? Back in tune to the Rankin Miss P. The Dread. Broadcasting Corporation. 103.8 every Friday night, right?
You got to feel it. It's in the
By having a black music station, it enables you to play music that would never ever be played on the radio. It would never be heard publicly. So it gives that musician a chance. It gives young black music labels a chance to get promotion, you know, to get somewhere in the music field, which right now reggae music is a back runner, you know, it doesn't really have much clout within the would I say the financial world of music, whereas there are many millions of people listening to reggae music and enjoying it, but it's just not properly represented, it's not put forward, and that's what we would like to do.
We'll eat tune to I'm on Choppy for the next hour, starting the show with Bob Marley, Buffalo Soldier.
If a record that wouldn't normally be heard is played by DBC, a listener will go and ask her record shop if it's there. Then he'll say, oh, well, I'll see if the distributor's got it. We create movement within the industry. About a year ago, we set up a studio which enables the DJs to pre-record all programs and then take transmitted equipment to a secret location and then to transmit the pre-recorded tapes, which lessens the risks for the DJs because, after all, we are doing this illegally.
Striving to be free, you know.
Because we are broadcasting illegally, some of our DJs are forced to remain anonymous because, you know, they don't know how it could affect them, especially in their works outside the station. So, you know, we're in a difficult position, really, because it does affect our private lives as well.
Well, the first time I went live, it felt like... How can you explain it? It felt like I know I'm doing something that's needed, and to hear yourself on come out on the radio is like a powerful feeling. And then when you learn that your friends are listening and the community's listening, it's a strange feeling. First, you have to get used to hearing your voice coming back at you from the radio, so that was kind of strange. But after a while, the feeling of knowing that you're doing something good became more stronger as the weeks and months went by. And the greatest feeling was going down the local high street, say, and hearing people talking about this new station. Amazing feeling that is, and kind of knowing that, you know, they don't know who you are and I'm listening, you know, it's nice. I tried to keep a low profile at the time, and not revealing who I was. A few people knew, a few record shop owners, etc. But then word gradually got out, you know, and the community kind of looked up to you, looked up to myself. And a lot of people started to write to the station to advertise certain local community things, which was great. Local community events. I remember Brent Park, like a park in Brent. It used to be like a sound system event every year. They used to get maybe two, three, four sounds to come and play in this park. And normally it would attract maybe a few hundred people. But we advertised it 1 year, and I think it was like 5,000 people come to the park from as far away as Luton and Slough.
Black radio continues to hold cultural and historical importance. We wanted to focus on Black radio in Canada, beginning with G98.7, also known as CKFG-FM. G98.7 is a Black-owned radio station in Toronto. Unfortunately, the station is now at risk of having its license bought and taken. We will now play an episode of the Broadcast Dialogue, the podcast featuring Aubrey Clark, Nova Nicole, Ian Andre Espinay, and Alicia West. This episode talks about keeping the Black voice on Canadian radio.
The reason for someone playing a song or not playing a song, taking on an issue or not, is completely different when those decisions are made by someone who is living within the community. What it really comes down to is a sense of belonging. And it's just absolutely unacceptable that people like my family have been here since 1830, or immigrants who've been here for 50 plus years, have no voice in a city like Toronto, the most diverse city in the world, NBA champions, I'll just add that, and a place where the greatest talent is coming out of here. So it just doesn't make sense. This math is not adding up, and it's absolutely not acceptable. And I don't think that it's a coincidence at all that this is just one of so many reflections of systemic racism. It's unacceptable.
So as a group, you believe that there should be a classification for Black radio, just like there is for Native radio.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. We need that protection. Definitely need that protection. My thing is, if the station fails as a Black-owned radio station, then it should be turned over to another Black group to run it and control our voice, right? Just like Indigenous radio was run by another group, and when it wasn't working out for them, APTN took it over, right? It never left the Indigenous community, right? And I think that's what it needs to stay with us. There are no more frequencies in Toronto. Toronto has the largest Black population in Canada. And without a voice here, a broadcast voice here, then the CRTC is not meeting their mandate for diversity of voices. So that's what I'm saying, that doesn't matter who wins that bid in the receivership. The CRTC really has to take into consideration that we have a public broadcast spectrum and the people's voice matters. We have over 11,000 people who've signed that petition already to say that, no, it's unacceptable. We have Mayor John Tory, the Premier Doug Ford, Andrea Horwath, the whole NDP Black Caucus and NDP Party, as well as others, have stepped up to say that it is unacceptable for the station not to be Black-owned.
I just wanted to intervene there for a second to speak to the idea of the station failing in the first place, in as much as there are so many systemic barriers that have been placed in its way.
Thank you, Ian.
The station 100%. Was almost set up to fail, in as much as the, you know, like, we could talk about everything from the classifications of the music, you know, to calling it urban, to segregating it from itself, to you break the music and we'll take it from here. All of these things, as well as the stereotypes and things that trickle their way up or down, whichever way you want to call it, to the ad agencies that say that we are only dealing with stations that have this many stations in their spectrum, or just basically brands that say that they are not going to advertise on a Black station because of the stigmas attached to it. All of these things are systemics that have been placed in the way of the success of that station. And consequently, you know, people will look at it and say, well, it failed, so why should they have it? But we have to look at the larger elements of why it failed in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And the standard of what that success looks like.
In support of Black voices in Canadian radio, please sign the Broadcast Dialogue petition, which we will be linking in our resource list at the end of our show.
On the topic of contemporary Black radio, we found some important conversations about expectations regarding etiquette of speech for those in radio and how these expectations are a symptom of white supremacy. We will be playing two short clips of Chenjerai Kumanaki. Chenjerai Kumanaki is a researcher, artist, journalist, and professor of journalism at Rutgers University. The first clip is a conversation between Chenjerai and A.D. Carson on the sound of mainstream radio, titled Vocal Color and Radio, followed by an interview with NPR on code switching.
Let's talk about the radio a little bit. When you hear, you know, I've tried to get you to like really get into This American Life and different public radio shows and stuff like that. What do you hear of the voices of those journalists? What do you hear?
I hear I hear middle-aged white dudes who sound like they just drank some really warm coffee.
And how do you connect? Like, how do you feel about that? I mean, because like, yo, I mean, I'm no doubt, right? Yes, but there's also like really compelling stories.
And I'm not against it. It's just that I know that it's a certain type of thing that's going on there, and I think that a lot of that is captured in that voice, in that you know, warm coffee sipping, you know, like whispering almost, like it sounds like the whole joint is recorded in the back of Barnes and Noble.
You crazy, man. All right, thank you.
That exchange was part of an essay Kumanyika posted this month on the public radio website Transom. It was called Vocal Color in Public Radio. We invited him to share his thoughts and tell us about his experience last summer at a Transom workshop when he got a turn at the microphone.
My piece was about a fisherman who manages the tuna club of Avalon. But while editing my script aloud, I realized I was also imagining another voice, one that sounded more white, saying my piece. Without being directly told, people like me learn that our way of speaking isn't professional, and you start to imitate the standard or even hide the distinctive features of your own voice. This is one of the reasons that some of my black and brown friends refuse to listen to some of my favorite radio shows, despite my most passionate efforts. This really affected me as I was producing my Transom piece. Sometimes I speak in the voice I'm using right now, but as a hip-hop artist, I use a very different voice. Check out this verse I wrote right after I found out that no one would be indicted for Eric Garner's death.
I can't breathe, hear my brother dying. Every day another name, another mother crying, oh Lord.
Now so the question is, how can I bring that kind of voice into my efforts as a radio producer, right? Now compare that to how I sounded on my first piece for the Transom workshop. For John, losing a fish is no small thing, because John is a fisherman with a capital F. Fisherman with a capital F. What does that even mean? So what bothers me most is the way I'm inhabiting my own personality. My voice sounds too high, and all the rounded corners of my slang are squared off. It's like I don't even recognize myself. It's like, who am I? Well, just as an experiment, I re-recorded part of that piece to see how a relaxed, sort of less code switch style of narration might sound.
You see, what you might not understand is that for John, losing a fish is no small thing. John is a real fisherman. I mean, this guy's caught hundreds of fish in his lifetime.
I'm not sure how much more effective it is, but I feel better listening to it. My voice is calmer, but hopefully not boring. Overall, it's like I feel more centered. I sound more like myself rather than myself pretending to be a public radio host. Of course, it's not just about what potential journalists face. It's also about the audience and the mission of public radio. Different hosts with different voices tell different kinds of stories. And vocal styles communicate important dimensions of human experience. What are we missing out on by not hearing the full range of those voices? Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. My wife and I spent some time in Ferguson, Missouri in August and November of 2014. I was standing on the block where Darren Wilson killed Michael Brown, and I asked one young man why he thought there had been such an uprising in Ferguson. He reminded me that Michael Brown's body had lain in the street for 4.5 hours before being picked up. Of course, I had heard this before in the news, but this young brother made me feel it. No one was there to translate. Instead, he carefully told the story his own way. I felt the weight of Michael Brown's body and the weight of so many other young lives in this young man's voice. So what do? We really have to think about who is the public in public media. The demographics of race and ethnicity are changing in the United States. The sound of public media must reflect that diversity. So get on it. It's time to make moves.
Let's focus for a moment on the CKUT and McGill community. In the past, McGill's BSN has hosted Black Talk on CKUT. Black Talk is a 12-hour program focused on Black achievements and experiences at McGill. Black Talk also focused on the connectivity between the, quote, history of prejudice towards Black people, unquote, and the current struggles of the Black community. BSN currently has episodes of Black Talk from 2019 and older ones from the 90s on their website. The program provides an active space for attention and care to current issues, while also providing a free space for Black creativity. We will now play some archival clips from Black Talk.
First up, we have a episode from 1992 titled Panel Discussion on Columbus, followed by another episode from 2019, a couple years later, titled Rest is a Right.
October 12, 1492. Columbus and crew arrive on Caribbean shores, laying claim to land, riches, and people. A mere three decades later, many indigenous populations had been completely exterminated by direct slaughter, disease, or mass suicides. North America, 1992, and millions of dollars have already been pumped into the celebration of Columbus's arrival 500 years ago and the reenactment of his voyage. For many cultural communities in North America, the arrival of Columbus is not a cause to celebrate. You're listening to Black Talk on CKUT. My name is Sharon Stewart, and I'll be your moderator for this hour-long panel discussion. Our topic is what the 500th anniversary of the coming of Columbus means to the Black community. Discussing this topic, we have with us Alfie Roberts, member of the Black Community Council of Quebec, Dr. Leo Bertley, who has authored books on the history of Blacks in Canada, and Professor Legrand, who is currently at McGill University teaching courses on Latin American history. Welcome, everybody. Perhaps we should begin discussing the consequences of Columbus's arrival, direct or otherwise, to the people who lived in the Caribbean. Alfie Roberts?
Yes, Columbus's arrival was catastrophic for the population that he met there, in that there was virtual genocide that was carried out, and that one can say it was a dress rehearsal for what was to take place later with respect to Black people. Two, an enduring legacy that we still have with, as a result of his coming, is that a substantial part of that area of the Caribbean is still under colonial control, under the control of Holland, England, France, and the United States of America.
Dr. Bertley, do you have any comments?
Yeah, when I think of Columbus, I think of many ideas. But the first one I would mention here is what I would call insensitivity. That the descendants and beneficiaries of Columbus can celebrate his quincentennial. Observe, yes, as we said in the Afro-Canadian, because it is a historic event of immense proportion. But how do you celebrate stealing of all the land? And never mind the Caribbean, let's take Canada, Canisataki and Kanawaki. They stole all the land, Columbus's descendants, the ones living now and living and listening to this program, if they are. They left a few rough spots for the owners of the land, and then they wanted to take it away to extend the golf course. And do you know something? The people who are defending their property are now before the white man's court, Columbus's court, mm-hmm. and being sent, I'm sure, to jail. That's what I think of. Another point I want to make, which I don't hear people say, how many white people were outside of Europe before Columbus? Today, as a result of Columbus, and I'm using him as a symbol now, obviously, mm-hmm. they own the whole world. Look at Canada. I live here. living here for 37 years. Look at the United States. Look at what they call Latin America, Australia, New Zealand, parts of Africa, parts of Asia. And you know what gets me very angry? And yet, those Europeans don't want one non-European in Europe. How many people of non-European descent have any significance at all in any of those European countries? So when I think of Columbus, I think of a small portion of humanity taking for themselves the world and its resources and fouling the world in the process. The rivers are no good anymore. We could hardly breathe the air. They're destroying, they have destroyed forests. They're destroying the Amazon even this now. And have the gall to turn around and say, not only we are celebrating the arrival of Columbus, but they expect Leo W. Burtley, this African born in Trinidad, to celebrate Columbus. They expect the native peoples to celebrate Columbus. That's what I mean by insensitivity. And let me...
Hey guys, this is Sarah Claudia Ligonde here with Chidera.
Hi guys. I'm a student at McGill studying Econ, African Studies, Poli Sci. I'm super excited to be here.
Amazing.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, you're welcome. You're very welcome. And we have...
Danil. Hi, yes. I'm Danil. I'm also at McGill, and I'm studying computer science and statistics.
Perfect.
Yeah, and I'm so excited to be here.
So excited as well. Yeah, it's going to be really good. Good times. Well, I mean, I just want to shout out the people that were before us. Fatou! Yes, we were... it was Che Chats, if I'm not mistaken. It's a really, really good segment. Dating advice. Woo. Let's get started with our show. It's called Rest is a Right, because rest is indeed a human right. It is something that we are all, owed in this world. We are all equal, and we all deserve to sleep, eat, rest. So basically, this the name of the show is based on my own documentary done with the Black Film Festival and the Fabian Kola Association. So it's basically called Rest is a Right, to commemorate the fact that Black women are strong, but that they also deserve to, you know, take some time off from sources of oppression and take care of themselves outside of those. We're going to be... commenting and basically paneling on the main questions of the strong Black woman. We're going to be demystifying the strong Black woman, starting with Chidera, and then going to Danielle and just doing a, you know, going back and forth. Yeah, Danielle.
Yes.
Oh my God, Danielle. I will not mess that up. Woo! It's for an hour. We're not going to mess that up for an hour. Danielle.
Yeah.
My girl, Danielle. Perfect. Amazing. Let's get started. So, what is the strong Black woman to you guys? How would you define the stereotype?
Well, to me, I feel like it's essentially a complex that was created to empower Black women, but also to ensure that they continue to take on all the labor that they do. And so in that way, it's a trap, because it's like, yes, I'm a strong Black woman that doesn't need a man, but also I am a strong Black woman who has all of this shit put on me. And because I'm strong, I should be able to take care of it. And so when you feel a little bit weak, when you feel a little bit down, like a normal human being, you kind of start to invalidate those feelings, which can be very detrimental to your mental health and physical well-being. And essentially, I feel like it's a very damaging stereotype.
Yeah.
Amen. That is very true.
Yeah.
How about you, Danielle?
I think it's a really, really, as Chidera said, like, it's not really a great stereotype. I think it means that I, as a Black woman, can't show my emotions, can't show that I'm weak, or can't show that, you know, I'm in this situation, and it's, and, you know, I need to maybe put on my, you know, I'm feeling all these feelings, but I can't show it. I have to put this brave face on. I have to be brave for everyone else, and that, my God, that, like, so sucks.
It's tough, man.
Yeah.
It definitely is a tough predicament to be in. I think that, you know, we also don't acknowledge enough the the intersections of Black womanhood. So let's say, for example, I mean, you're still Black and you're still a woman. And the thing with Black bodies, they have been seen as not, you know, having any, like, being able to experience any pain for a very, very long amount of time, which was a way to justify slavery for the longest time in coordinating with Christianity. I definitely think that the strong Black woman, as Shidera mentioned, is like, you know, this kind of cop-out. This kind of like, yeah, you should be doing this. You know, we're going to congratulate you for doing that, but you're not doing the bare minimum like everybody else. You're not being mediocre. You're being great. And we want to keep you in those positions of caretaking. And I think that that's, you know, that's exactly that, the damage of the stereotype. And having to take on so much, as Neil mentioned, it's really disgusting. You know, I really, really wish we were able to just come together and look at each other as humans and not just anything people project onto us.
As we conclude our Black History Month feature, we want to acknowledge that although we focused on Western narratives, Black history goes beyond the North American and British scope. Furthermore, as important as this month is when it comes to prioritizing Black voices, stories, and injustice, non-Black folks must continue to center their activism, research, knowledge on history, journalism, and discussions on inequality around anti-Black racism. This month is necessary, however, the priority of Black voices must be present throughout the year.
We will now read our resource list for this week.
The first resource we have is an academic paper published by Dr. Jenny Berman titled Colonialism and Postcolonialism. I had the privilege of taking Dr. Berman's class this semester. She's taught a lot, but this one's Comms 320. It's an assigned reading for the course, which is Media and Empire. And basically the paper looks at how colonial powers use communications to assert control over spaces and how revolutionaries seize these tools for their own anti-colonial purposes. It's the reading that we mentioned in the intro for the segment. And if you want to learn more about media technologies and imperialism, I highly recommend that you take Dr. Berman's course.
Next, we have Archives of African American Music and Culture. As stated on their website, quote, established in 1991, the Archives of African American Music and Culture, also known as the AAMC, is a repository of materials covering a range of African American musical idioms and cultural expressions from the post-World War II era. Our collections highlight popular religious and classical music with genres ranging from blues and gospel to R&B and contemporary hip hop. The AAMC also houses extensive materials related to the documentation of Black radio, unquote. So check that out if you want to learn more. We've used that resource for our segment, and it's very thorough and very informative.
Next, we have BSN, McGill. This source is at the top of our list. It's a website for McGill's own Black student network with resource lists, events, archives, and other extensive projects. It's really helpful in learning about community experience and what you can do around campus. You can also listen to Black Talk here.
Next up, we have the petition to keep CKFM 98.7 in Toronto, Black owned and operated. So this is the radio station that was discussed earlier in our segment, and we just linked the change petition, and it would be really helpful for you guys to sign it and keep Black radio voices alive and thriving.
Next up, we have the article that we mentioned on Black British Pirate Radio titled Sound of the Underground, How Black Britain Changed the Face of UK Radio. It's written by Toby Chiramatang, and basically explores the history of Black pirates.
Amalo ne pebo mutu masugete. Ulume ojale malangan ila ekayokta kunna tu de ma ekayokta gaswasu matata manna esuma amalo epigitiano metano ojale majo halangan mayok. tena pisuti ukhane ma khata khala ma yutena denjamik dana ukhau tsaga dola ngajo asio majoet inu akta majoet nu na khakhak se majoet agnait amalo ni beaksa murdered and missing indigenous women and girls amalo nik hansen me ukhale ma khata khala ma yugut dana nik hansen terabe chakko takutso so eskimo ninjo nirasuk amalo nicho tene ne enotito tene tu sa khatara ngamegata nara tu inagetse. Hi, my name is Annie Pisuti. Today is February 16, 2021, and welcome to Nipibut. On today's show, we will be speaking about mental wellness and self-care. Dina Pisuti speaks with Dana Danger about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And we have an interview with Nick Hansen. Nick Hansen, a.k.a. the Eskimo.